Okay.
Six lines from the rock top.
No, no, no. We're further down than that. All right. Okay. Let me explain, first of all, what night is tonight? Oh, the 31st of August of 2005. Okay. And we're struggling with the... We want to finish up the cheese, so we didn't go into other areas. Okay.
So where are we?
So we are on Habitus Zara 35B, and we are approximately about 9-10 lines from the bottom. All right. The last Inyan that we had recorded was the problem about Orlog. I don't know if you remember. Orlog, remember, this refers to a tree during the first 3 years that you can't use it. And then after that, the fourth year, yes, but of course, in the days of old, what they used to do, they used to have to go to Yerushalayim in order to enjoy the fruits, or they would sell the fruit and take the money and spend it in Yerushalayim, I mean, like they did with Maaseh Sheni. Okay. So at any rate, the question is, if it's Orba, to what part of the tree does it apply? Okay? So he says that as far as okay, it says Afil Tema Rabbi Yeshua, it says I calmly put the Rabbi Yeshua lay the Rabbi Eliezer and be caught for the guza above the caught for the peri moida, meaning what? Meaning that if the juice that they're using in order to serve as a curdling agent for the cheese. This is what, remember, they were talking about curdling agents, okay?
Yeah.
So he says that if it is, let's say, the roots of a tree or the leaves of the tree, then in that particular case, this would not be subject to the law of Orla. And any juice that they got out of that, that would be okay. Understand? It would not be in violation of the laws of kashrus, you know, as far as curdling is concerned.
Provided it was a tree that was more than 3 years old.
We're talking even if it was younger. Because what the point that they're making is, above the cut for the pay ray, motive. But even he who is, you know, more lenient than this, so... when it comes to the juice that you would get out of the fruit itself, in that particular case, he would agree, you know, that you can't use it as a curdling agent because it would be a violation. The Hainu did none, and therefore this is what we've learned in the Mishnah, which says, Omer Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Yeshua said, Shamati befeirush, I've heard clearly, Shemaamid b'shraf ha'elin v'shraf ha'ikorin, that if somebody uses as a curdling agent the juice of the leaves or the juice
of
the or the sap, whatever you want to call it, or the sap of the roots, then the muta, then in that case it's okay because it would not be a violation of the Orlor rule. But the Shraf HaPagin, if he used instead the you know, the juice of unripe grapes. Why do we say unripe grapes, Pagan? Because obviously, if the tree is young, we have to assume that the fruit, you know, the figs are not ripe enough as yet, right? So also he says that would be prohibited. They should pay it because it's a fruit. And he says, Ben Rav Kista, Ben Rav Nachman, Bar Yitzchak, Ketzev Hanor. Then therefore, in accordance with the will, whichever opinion is about Chista, is about Nachman, by Yitzchak, doesn't make any difference. Mm-hmm. That it would be prohibited for any, you know, any use, for any benefit, whatever. So he says, Kasha, pockets, that's a difficult matter. Okay? So then it says, we cut back again to Shir HaShirim, if you remember. The Dorash Rab Nachman, Beredat Chista. So Rab Nachman, the son of Rab Kista, made the following drasha, so to speak. In other words, he interpreted the following verse in the following manner. He says, "My dichsiv, what is the meaning of the verse in Shir HaShirim, which says, the reach shimonecha tovim, which means with the fragrance, the beautiful fragrance of your precious oils." So And it says, you know what that refers to? He says, Lema Talmud Chochem Doime. He says, what can you compare a Talmud Chochem to? He says, it's Lochi Shel Plaitan, to a, like a vase that contains Plaitan. Plaitan is like a bomb inside of it, okay? And Megula, Recho Nodev, when it is uncovered, then its fragrance spreads. Mechusa, but if it is covered up, right? So in Recho Nodev, then in that particular case, the fragrance that's contained inside, you know, the vessel, inside the jar, is not, doesn't spread. The Lord, not only that, alright, first of all, I mean, what is the point of the bushel, we would say? Obviously, what he wants to say is that a Talmud Chacham, who keeps everything to himself, right, is not effective enough. It's fine, I mean, to have the knowledge, but your fragrance is not being spread to others, where it should be. So that, therefore, you have to uncover that jar which holds you, which holds your Torah, and spread it to others as well. And then they give another interpretation as well. They say, the Lord, not only that, he says, not only that, but when a Talmud Chacham finds difficulty, literally, things are covered from him. In other words, he doesn't understand a particular idea either, right? So through talking it over with others, then what happens? In that case, Mizgalamlo, it becomes revealed unto him himself. He understands better things that he didn't understand as a result of discussing it with others. Shinemar, as the Pasuk continues to say, Alomos Ahibucha. This is also from the same Pasuk, you know, in Shir Hashirim. It says, literally, the maidens love you. So he says, Kori Bealumos. Don't interpret it as Alomos, but interpret it as Alumos, things that are hidden. In other words, things that are hidden now become what? They become beloved by virtue of the fact that they become spread, you know, and shared with others. Below all, not only that, Ela Shabalach HaBoris Ohavo. Not only that, but the angel of death loves him. In other words, will give him a peaceful death. Shenemar Alomos Ahayvucha. Okay? And he says, Kori Bei Almus. Don't read it as Alomos, but read it as Almus, in the sense that the one who is the angel who's designated, you know, to take care of death, right? So he shows you love. The Lord, not only that, not only that, but he will also inherit two worlds. One world that he'll inherit is this world, because of the fact that, you know, he's living and sharing with others his knowledge of Torah, inspiring them. The Echod, Ho'elam Haba, and the other one is the world to come. Shenemar, again, Alomos, right? And he says, Kiri Bey, read it or interpret it as Olamos. Olamos is, of course, the plural of the word Olam. So therefore, the plural shows that it is not only this world, but it's also the world to come. So, yes. Yeah, probably the either in the back there's one.
What?
You have to experiment.
What's the matter?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Actually, there are three such switches that will operate. that one, and that one over there. So, but whichever one you operate, it cancels out the other two. You understand? All right. So with that, we have finished cheese, and now we go on to other problems.
What does the word Alamos really mean?
Alamos really means maidens.
Maidens?
Maidens, right.
But
Singular is the word Alma.
Alma, yeah.
Remember that famous verse in Yeshayahu?
Nothing to do with Alma.
No, it has nothing to do with it. No, it's spelled differently.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, Alma.
Okay.
It's a very famous word, pasuk in Yeshayahu, where he sees a young woman passing by, and he notices that she's pregnant. And so he says, Neha Alma, right? Behold, that this young woman who's passing by, all right, she's pregnant, she'll bear a child, and his name will be, the Prince of Peace and stuff like that. So needless to say, the Christians seized upon this only... that's from Yeshayahu, Sar Shalom, right? Right. So at any rate, the Goyim seized upon this idea, only they translated the word. Instead of translating it as young woman, they translated it as virgin. So this is the whole business with the virginizers. Okay. All right. What can we do? It's been mistranslated for 2,000 years now. But almost the feminine of the word Elam. Elam is a young man, and Alba is a young woman. Okay. All right. New Mishnah. The Elam Devorim Shalodei Kachavim Asurin the Enison Isur Hanar. All right. The previous Mishnah, with all the following pages, in general spoke about things that not only are prohibited to us, let's say for eating or for drinking, but also they are prohibited to us in order to derive benefit from it. Now, not everything, as we saw, there are exceptions to these different things, but still, that was in general the idea behind the previous Mishnah. Okay? This Mishnah, however, says the following things are prohibited to us, but we can derive benefit from them. Okay? The Enusun Israel, the prohibition does not extend to a prohibition on benefit from them. And the first thing is Cholov Shechalov Eve Kochovim, the Ein Yisrael Rehu. Milk that a goy has built without a Jew seeing the milking process. Remember, we've spoken in the past about the idea of kosher milk as compared to non-kosher milk. So, right, the idea of Kol Yisrael is based upon this. All right, so let's say if we say that only if a Jew is standing by does this make the milk kosher. What if a Jew were not standing by? Could you use the milk? No, you can't drink it. But what can you do? You can sell it. That hadol you can have. You understand? Okay. The next item. Hapas. The bread of a goy. A goyish bread. Okay? The hashemen shalahem. And likewise their oil. Now when we say oil, of course we mean olive oil. Okay? And now the Mishnah says that Rabbi Yuvez Dino Hitiro Hashemen says that Rabbi, meaning Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and his Bezdin and Yavda, they permitted the use of non-Jewish olive oil. Okay? Another thing prohibited is Hashlokes. Okay? Shlokes. What are Shlokes? Shlokes are like vegetables that are cooked or something like that.
No.
Shlokos. Shlokos. Think of shlok.
Okay.
So shlokos means cooked foods, okay? Obviously, cooked by whom? Cooked by a goy. Of course, when we say goy, I mean, technically we're saying Rebet Kerchovim, right, an idolater, right. And as Rashi says, even for this, the kli tohor, right? A clean vessel, meaning, you know, that the vessel itself might be a kosher vessel. If there is no Jew involved in supervising it. It's, of course, what how it's interpreted, you understand? Then in that particular case, you cannot use that food, not you cannot eat that food, but again, such food could be given to others, served to others, whatever it may be. So, okay, yes.
From this we derive that if you go, let's say,
non-kosher restaurant.
And you eat, you know, cooked zucchini.
Right.
By the fact that there wasn't any hashkafa there, that even though the food itself is...
That according to this Mishnah, it would be prohibited. Right. Right. Exactly. And another thing, a kevoshim, shadakim, let's say, sasechen, yayin. What are kevoshim? Kevoshim are things that sort of like you pickle or you marinate, let's say marinate, right? And what are you using for the marination? You are using wine or vinegar. And of course, again, when we talk about vinegar, we mean specifically wine vinegar. Okay. So, again, that would be prohibited.
Preserved, huh?
Yeah. Like, for example, let's say pickles. If they used, or, you understand? Maybe herring or something like that. I mean, technically, I mean,
so
I don't have to tell you that there are differences of opinion. I mean, but
prohibited to eat.
Prohibited to eat.
What we may
if it's
sell.
Yeah, right. So therefore, I mean, this is why we say these things require hashkafa. They require kosher supervision, and in that case, we can have it. You see. Okay. The Tauris terufa. Tauris is a kind of a fish, sort of like a sardine-sized fish or something like that, that in those days, Rashi says, in other words, a kind of tiny fish which have been salted, and then it's trufa. Trufa means that it's been broken up into little pieces, and you're not able to recognize whether this is a kosher fish or whether the possibility is that something else has been mixed in together with it, which is not kosher. The tzir she'em bo doga kalbis. Okay. What is tzir? Tzir is brine, in which it doesn't have this fish called the doga kalbis floating in it. So you can't see it, so therefore the brine... Okay, let's take a look at the Rashi for a moment. He explains, B'tzir she'en bo doga kalbis she'tet etzmoi. He says, she'derach kalbis the godel be'yaveho b'tzir shel dogim toherim. He says, the usual kalbis, it grows by itself in the brine of kosher fish. But if there is the brine of an unkosher fish with it, then the kalbis cannot grow in it. But in itself, it is prohibited. So the question is, how do we identify it? You understand? That's a different problem. Okay. The achilik, that's also another kind of a fish. Also, according to Rashi, it says, "Bidogim kintanim tahirim." It's a kind of kosher fish. He's sultanis. That's also called sultanis. What about this fish? I think by this it means something like a sturgeon or something like that. The ain was napier kaskeses, right? When it is young, it has no fins and scales. Okay. The also the gadil laachasban napier kaskeses. When it becomes more adult, more mature, then in that case it first develops fins and scales. The kaim along, and we have a tradition that says the muteris, that it should be permitted because eventually it does grow, right? But the Yoma, the Gemara, But the Gemara will tell us, b'pnei ma'asavuha, why did they prohibit it? He says, b'pnei she'irbuna ela ibo dogim tamei ma'adoimim ba. Because it's easy enough to mistake this with, you know, with the unkosher fish. Okay? And here we're not talking about lo shto trufa. It makes no difference whether it's chopped up. But lo shto ena trufa. And even if it's, you know, never been chopped up, this fish. But ikal mechosh, you have to be afraid about the fact that maybe this is not a kosher type of a fish, but it's an unkosher type of a fish. And in that particular case, if it's an unkosher fish, then it's the echot b'yelot b'dehem, the domolei. Even if you have 1,000 kosher fish that are similar to it, this one fish would also remain treif. You understand? I mean, we've heard, you know, about its bottle. Certain things, we say, a bottle of barov. In other words, if the majority, you know, is kosher, then in that particular case, the minority is also declared kosher. We have other things where we say it's bottle b'shishim. In other words, where you need 60 times the amount in order to declare it kosher, okay? But there are also things where we say that afil echod b'elef, it still remains treif. So this is the point that Rashi is making, he says. Here the fish is so similar to treif of fish because you don't see any fins and scales on it that you could easily be mistaken. And as a result, you might think that it's kosher. It's not, even among 1,000 kosher.
Well, it's on.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Ladies first, go ahead.
I was going to say, cooked fish, other
right.
than herring,
yeah.
would be wonderful because that's on the whole fish, you can see it. But cooked fish would not have the fins and scales in any way. You don't.
Yeah, but when the fish is raw, when the
but
fish is raw, you're able to see it.
Already, right?
We would ask before that question if it's already been cooked by a goy.
Yeah.
Okay?
So
and we don't know, I mean, in that particular place, okay. then that fish is not good. Yeah. So.
I have an objection, though.
Fine, you can object.
Humble as I am to this,
it's all right.
Why did the Rabbanim, who are extremely logical, say once the fish is adult and you can see the scales and the fins, then we'll differentiate it from the 999 other fish?
Yeah.
Because at that point it's easy to see that it's a kosher fish. Only when it's young, which I suppose it'd be like a, I don't know what the word you use,
yeah, all right,
a
right.
small yeah. fish, I'm trying to think.
Yeah.
Then at that stage will say that it's prohibited because of the similarity and the difficulty of picking
okay.
it up.
Well, look, you realize that this is one of the points of difference between the orthodox interpretation and, let's say, the conservative, where that they say, all right, sturgeon, it's okay.
Swordfish
is okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we don't accept it, that's all. We have to be more machmir in this case. I mean, there is such a doubt that in that particular case, the doubt should really be the full bread. Because when you're dealing with something which is prohibited by the Torah, then in that case, the rule is that sfeik the raisa. In other words, if it's doubtful that it may be a violation of the Torah law, then it's the chumrah. Then in that particular case, you should be mafia. You should be more strict. If it is sfeik rabbanon, then in that case, you can have the kula. So it all depends, you know, what are we violating, okay?
Sturgeon,
what are we questioning? Yes.
Sturgeon, I would understand when it's an adult fish, it's prohibited to us. I don't understand why that analogy would hold in this case where when it's young, it looks too much like a fish that has no scales or fins.
Yeah.
When it's older, it's obvious it does have fins or scales.
Okay.
Why don't...
No, I understand.
Really,
some say also, that the scales are not really scales, there's something else, and so on.
Is that what the sturgeon... why do they say the sturgeon is not good? It's not good.
Because to begin with, it doesn't have the scales on it.
It does not have scales
to begin with.
You know, sturgeon was one of the big things that they always had in the so-called kosher, in the kosher jellies.
Absolutely.
What about, I want to ask you this.
All the kosher jellies had it.
Sturgeon, even though it has no scales.
No.
I have two questions. One is, I was someplace where I was looking and they had catfish. Apparently, that's not a kosher fish.
Not considered kosher. No.
Why is that? What is catfish?
It's hideous.
It's a hideous fish, right? I don't think it has scales.
It doesn't have scales?
Probably not.
No one.
We have a general rule that if a fish has scales, undoubtedly it must have fins also. But you have to look for the scales. This is the
and the swordfish.
There are fish that also lose that scale, right? So that's already a different problem, correct?
And the swordfish. Could you just explain that? A swordfish kosher or not?
We don't accept that it's a kosher fish. Okay.
Why is that? Because the reason.
Do I know? I'll be honest with you. I am not a fish expert.
I think
at
some point in its life cycle, it doesn't have skin.
Probably. That's probably the reason.
I learned years ago that it had to do with there were different species. And there might be a species that did have a scale, but since there was a species that did not, that we wouldn't accept any of that, because when they're in the store, you don't know which you're getting.
Right. True. This is why, frankly, it's good if you can buy a piece of fresh fish where you can actually see whether it has. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So you knew it.
Right.
You know, the problem today is with some fish, they got IFC in front of them. They call it Chilean sea bass. Huh. It's not really a sea bass, but whether it's kosher or not, it's anybody's guess. They can label. You know, they can label different things.
Uh-huh.
You know, they can have labels that are marked for marketing purposes.
Right.
But not necessarily, if you go by the name.
If something is labeled, are we not supposed to go by the label?
What we're supposed to go by is as to whether the thing actually has a heksher on it or it doesn't. This is why it's so important to really be looking at all times to see whether it has certification or not.
Aren't there some trout that are kosher and some that aren't? Rainbow, brook trout?
As far as I know, trout is a kosher fish, but again...
But there are some that aren't. Some that don't have scales, some trout species.
There are some lists of kosher fish, but I have never seen a list which includes every single fish in the world. Yeah. The most common, let's say, the most common 30 types of fish or something like that.
But we don't even have access to all of the fish. I mean,
True.
The markets just have the limited few.
All right, let's finish the Mishnah, and I think we'll call it a night, okay? All right. Now, the next two items are not fish.
Okay.
They're not bread, they're not oil. But it's for korachel chiltis, umera shalkundis. Okay. So the first question is, so what's a korachel chiltis? So the chiltis, Rashi says that it's a type of a fruit. Some say it's more like a vegetable or something, right? That they call lazra, in French, old French, I'm not even familiar with what it is. And he says, v'chatchim es karotov, the sakin, Okay. What they do is that they have to cut this root, you know, with a knife. They also, and so what is the reason why we prohibit it? It says, Mishum Shabnu Nisi Disakino. Because very often the knife that they use has fat on it. And it might be trefa fat, you understand? So because it requires a knife, we now are entering into an area where I have to tell you, there are those who are, at least in ancient days, they were very machmir about the use of knives, specifically because of the fact that very often they used oil or whatever they be, or the fact that what they were cutting was so pungent that it left a taste on the knife. And in that case, we're afraid that it might be used for something else, which was not right. So these are the reasons why this particular thing was prohibited. And the other one, mel shel kundis, some kind of a salt, which the Gemara is going to tell us later on, that again, they used it in order to smear lard and stuff like that with it. So because they used this kind of salt together with lard, so that there's the prohibition for it. But again, the Mishnah concludes by saying, Harei Eva Asurin, these things are prohibited for us, you know, to eat or drink, whatever it may be, but the Ein Isurun is Ha'anor. Nevertheless, the prohibition does not extend to deriving any benefit from it. So I think we'll conclude with this Mishnah, and then next week, Amir Sahasheh. Okay, so tonight is the 7th of the month of September in the year 2005. We are now going to continue with the Gemara's commentary upon the Mishnah that we have on Daf Lamed Hay, Omid Beis. Avodah Zarah 35b. And as we'll see, the Gemara goes into every one of the things mentioned in the Mishnah in order to try to find the reason for it or whether it's exactly the way it is and so on. So we stopped. First thing that it says over there is Cholav Lamai. Cholav Lamai. Question is, why do we prohibit the milk that a Jew was not standing over it in order to make sure, you know, that it was okay, that he wasn't using any treif of milk, right? Why? And the Gemara says, well, nichish lo, Lamai nichish lo, why are we suspicious of it? This is what the Gemara is asking. So it says, imishum ichlufei tohor chiver tomei yorok. So first of all, he says, if you're worried about the fact that it might be that the goy is substituting the milk of a trefa animal for the milk of a kosher animal, but we have a simon, as we would say, we have a way to know the difference between the two, in that tohor, if it's pure milk, in other words, let's say cow's milk, right, or sheep milk or goat milk, then chiver, the milk is white. Tomei, on the other hand, the milk of unclean animals, the color is yorok, which either can be translated as green or yellow or something like that. But anyway, it certainly is not white. Okay? So, knocking down one thing so far. Okay? And then, the next question. The imishum iruve, and if what we're worried about is, you know, that they're mixing the two milks together, don't need them. So let's test them out by using them in order to make, in order to curdle the milk and see what the results are. The Omar Mar, as one of the authorities said, Cholov Tahor Olmeid, and Cholov Tamei Eino Olmeid. He says that milk which is pure, which, in other words, milk, you know, which is the milk of a pure animal, he says, that will curdle. Olmeid over here, you don't translate it as stands, but it means that it serves as a curdling agent. It curdles the, okay? It can curdle, good. And on the other hand, if it is the milk of a tome, you know, of an unclean animal, then in that particular case, it won't curdle, okay?
It won't curdle.
It won't curdle, right.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And then he says, Edekoboy Ligvino, right? Yeah, if, yeah, you know, it doesn't curdle if he wants it for cheese. Edekoboy Ligvino, if he wants it for cheese. So they say, Hochinami, Hochabe Mineskin. Okay. Okay, likewise he says, what are we dealing with? He says, the koboy lay, the kamcho, right? He says, well, we want to try it, we want to test it out. He says, well, kamcha. What is kamcha? Kamcha is some kind of a milk dip or something or other. In other words, it's something that's made with a little milk inside. Okay? So the question is, can we test it out like that? As for example, way back we learned something about something called Kusach HaBavli. What's the Kusach HaBavli? This was something, a mixture of bread and milk that was cooked together, and the question is only, you know, was it kosher or was it not, or something like that. But apparently it was a popular dish. And so,
does that mean in Babylon?
Babylonia, right,
yeah.
Right. In other words, the Babylonians, the favorite dish of the Babylonians, right. So, that being the case, you know, you could try it out to see. So, all right, so that's what the question is right now, okay? Yeah. So he says, "Venishkol mine kali." All right, so let's take a little bit of the milk that we have, venikum, and let's try to curdle it. Came in the mitoher, nami yikosyo. So he says it's not a 100% accurate test. Why? Because even if the milk is pure, right, it's still going to have whey in it. The lokayame, right? Because in as much as you're not standing on top of it, right, to watch the whole process, so lekel mekavalo the milsa. So you cannot really determine whether it is kosher or not. So that being the case, this is one of the reasons then why they decided that. They should ban the milk of an idolater if a Jew is not standing by him to watch the milking process to make sure that he's only milking kosher milk. Okay?
So they don't trust the curd.
Right, right. They don't trust it 100%. Right. The Eboy is able, and if you wish, you can say, I feel it, take me to Kaboy and the Gavina. But even if he needs this milk for cheese, and you know, he would see whether it'll curdle or won't curdle. But he says, "Ika dekai beda atfa." There's still drops that are going to fall in between the holes in the cheese and so on. So we cannot be 100% sure. All right. Of course, you know, that leads to the following problem, and that is that the authorities, such as Rav Moshe Feinstein, as we know, the great authority for American Jewry, that he decided that the laws of the United States are strict enough so that you don't require to have a mashgiach present at all times, you know, when the milking is taking place. Nevertheless, as we know, there are people who are still very, very strict about it, and therefore they'll drink only Kol of Israel, where definitely there is a Mashiach who's there doing the milking process. So this is the way it is. Yes. Oh, yeah, that was a question about, right, Gerelich at one time wanted to use for the vitamin aspect, you know, pardon me?
A hormone?
Not a hormone, no, but a fish oil taken, let's say, from shark or something like that, shark liver or something, wherever it came from. And as a result, the VH, not the OU, it's the VH, refused to give, to give recognition to this particular milk as kosher until they stopped using it. But once they did, so you'll find the VH now back again on Gerelich's milk. So the lesson is, don't experiment with things that you don't have permission to do.
Pardon me? They use a lot of hormones in the milk now. Somebody told me that once you had 2 gallons, the car top used to say 2 gallons a day, by giving them hormones, doubling the amount, so they can get 4 gallons.
Yeah, that could be. That could be.
Hormones are carcinogenic.
Yeah. One of the brands, the New Square, which is one of the kosher brands, I think that that's the brand that they're selling over here in Big Y, they advertise the fact that there's no BST in it. The BST is the hormone. Okay. So if you're afraid of hormones, stay away from it. Okay. All right. So as we see, as time went on, the prohibition, you know, it became weakened. But if you want to observe, by all means, the opportunity is here in order to observe. You don't have to worry about milk that's built in Eretz Yisrael, because over there, there are Jews always involved in the milking process. But I don't know, did you ever go to see a dairy in Eretz Yisrael?
I did on a kibbutz, I saw.
Yeah, right. They have these electric milkers, you know. Yeah. They simply attach pipes right to the animal's teats, and it just milks it automatically and so on. Right.
But they do that here too now.
Yes, they do. Oh, yeah, right, absolutely. Yeah. But all the milk there, of course, is produced by Jews, so that is not the problem of the Kol of Israel. It's impossible. And therefore, of course, remember, it extends to cheese too. Because the question with cheese is, you can have kosher cheese, but it's not necessarily Kol of Israel cheese. If it's Kol of Israel cheese, they'll state specifically on the package, normally, that they are Kol of Israel. Okay? There's Kol of Israel ice cream that's available in New York. Okay? Well, there's an outfit by the name of Klein. Some of it is distributed over here. Right? This particular, you'll see around Pesach time, when they get in more orders. So. Yeah. But, you know, in New York, it's common.
Is it available up here, Pesach time?
Yeah, they usually get a couple of cartons of ice cream and something.
Oh,
yeah.
Ice cream.
Right. Yogurt is also, it's Holy Israel yogurt, absolutely. You can go into Big Y and you pick it up. Well, they have the kosher cheeses and so on. So they also have yogurt over here. Morningstar, for example, is a kosher one. It's Kol of Israel.
Whole section of dairy.
Right, right, yeah. More expensive, as a general rule, than the than let's say Dannon, which has an OU on it. But by the way, you got to watch, Dannon, right. Once it has fruit on the bottom, usually they have gelatin in it. So somebody gives him a K. But a person who is careful will not rely upon the K. All right. In that case.
I wouldn't use them for the amount of sugar.
Yeah, that's another thing. That's true. Right.
I buy the plain and I add my own food.
Right, right. Yeah, this is what they recommend.
That's what I do.
Right. Right. Okay, next item on the agenda, hapas, bread. All right. Amarab Kana, all right. Amarab Yochanan. All right, Rav Kana said the name Rav Yochanan, he says, Pas lo hutra bevezdim. He says, bread was not permitted, in other words, not permitted to be used by the bezdim. So they say, no, miklal the ikor mandishori. If you tell me that the bezdim said that you should not use goyish bread, then in that case, obviously there must have been somebody who said, to begin with, it's okay to use goyish bread. Of course, we're not talking about goyish bread which contains treifa elements, but we're talking about a bread which is absolutely, I mean, from the point of view of its preparation and so on, I mean, is kosher, but yeah, I'm not sure now whether I've recorded what I thought so far or not. All right. Anyway, now the question is with bread. All right? So, if it says that the Besdin prohibited it, then maybe somebody did permit it, right? So they say, in, yeah, pakazoi. Why? The Chiyosa Rabdimi, when Rabdimi came for Eretz Yisrael, he came to Babylonia, he reported, Omar, he said, Pa'am achas, once upon a time, Yosef Rabbi, Lassad, Rabbi went out to the field. Behavi oivi kechovim lifonov pas puron mafeso, and a certain idolater happened to come along, and this idolater, he brought a loaf of bread that was baked in a great big oven, and it weighed a so'ah. Okay, in other words, let's say, who knows, a 2 pound of bread or something like that. So Omar Rabbi, so Rabbi said, Oy, kamo no pasu, how beautiful this loaf of bread is. Maru chachom niyosra. Why did the rabbis prohibit it? Maru chachomim. What is the reason that they prohibited it? So it had to be Mishum Chatzonis. I mean, we know that the reason is because they wanted to make sure that Jews and Goyim would not get together on such intimate basis that it would lead to intermarriage. Elamaru Chachomim Liosre Baseda. So they shifted a little bit and they say, so Rabbi says, no. So why did the sages prohibit it even in the field as compared to what? As compared to the city. Right? So it says, Kisvurin ha'om, right? All right. Let me backtrack a couple of moments. Okay. It says, why do they prohibit it in the field? All right. So what is it, as we said, in the city, we can understand maybe why the reason for the prohibition, because people are there, they rub shoulders all the time, you know, it's a close proximity between Jew and idolater, right? And therefore, we're afraid about this business that it might lead to intermarriage. But why in the field, where there are very few people, there isn't that much contact, why shouldn't we be able to eat it over here, right? His worm are on, right? So people are the impression that hiter rabbi hapas, that in this particular case, then the rabbi said, it's okay to eat non-Jewish bread. Right? Velohi. But that's not so. Rabbi lohitir is hapas. Rabbi did not permit the use of Jewish bread. Okay. Well, so at the moment, we have the idea that maybe he did, maybe he didn't permit the use of bread which was baked by a non-Jewish baker, right? Rav Yosef Yitemor, Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda, Omar. Rav Yosef, and there are those who say it wasn't Rav Yosef, it was Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda. At any rate, one of them said, Lo kacho yamasa. No, wait a minute, they're not telling the story right. What happened is not exactly that way. Elo omru, but as follows. Pa'am achas, halach rabbi, limokim echod. Rabbi went to a certain place, ro'ah pas dochuk latalmidim, and he saw that there wasn't enough bread in order to feed his students. Omar Rabbi. So Rabbi said, Ein kan palter? Isn't there a baker around here? Kisburn ha'om. So people thought, Lomar, that what he means is palter oivet kechovim. Right? In other words, a non-Jewish baker. In other words, people thought that what he was saying is that it's okay if what? A non-Jewish baker will bake the bread, you know, for the olam over here. The Hulu Omar, but what he really meant was, Ella, what? Palter Israel? A Jewish baker. So, that being the case, we're back again to square one, right? Which is the prohibition against the use of non-Jewish bread, bread baked by a non-Jew. So Omar Rab Chelbo, so Rab Chelbo said, Afilu l'man doma paltu evit kochovim, le'y amaron ela deleke paltu Yisrael. Okay. So Rab Chelbo comes and he says, look, even where they say that there's an opinion that says that if you have a goyish baker, it's okay, you know, provided you know everything is all right with his baking, the ingredients, etc., etc., even though you don't have a Jew standing over there, okay? But they did not apply, that literally, they didn't say that this Ella de Leka Palti Yisrael, that's only where there isn't a Jewish baker. Avol, but Mekrem de Yikor Palti Yisrael, lo. But where you have a Jewish baker, actually, you don't go to whom? Don't go to a Jewish baker. You go to a Jewish baker. Rabbi Yochanan Omar, Rabbi Yochanan said, Afilu leban doma palter oivet kochovim. Again, and even according to the authority who said that you could use the bread of the Jewish baker, ha neimile basodeh, that would apply only in the field where, as we said, what? People are scarce, and, you know, we're not worried about intimacy between Jews and goyim. Avol be'ir, lo. But in the city, no. Mishum chasonis, because of the fact that we want to discourage intermarriage. Aivu hayamenakis v'yochil ta sabay mitzorei. Aivu was taking a piece of bread and eating it at the border. Now, obviously, what kind of bread are we talking about? People are figuring, you know, that he's eating goyish bread. Okay? So, Abalahu Rava. So, Rava said to him, the Tabor of Nachum Yitzchak. And there are those who say it wasn't Rava, but it was Nachum by Yitzchak. He says, Loi tishtoi ba'adid evo. He says, don't listen to any halachic opinion given by evo, because he's eating goyish bread. He was a rabbi. He was he's mentioned quite often in the Talmud. Evo, right, that's his name. At least that's what it looks like, Evo. There are no dots over here, remember.
What is the root for
tishtah? Yeah, tishtah. No, that's Aramaic.
Oh,
it's Arabic. So to converse, to talk, right. Right. So, right.
His reputation wasn't good.
Right, his reputation wasn't good because they saw him eating, right. I mean, like if you would see the rabbi enter a tray for restaurant, right, to eat. How do you feel about it? Do you understand? Don't feel good about it.
How does a rabbi feel about it?
It's a different story. The Mero tells a story about his rabbi down in Sarasota over there, that he eats at all the tray for restaurants. So Mero once said to him, "Rabbi, how come you eat over there?" He says, "I want to set the example for my congregation as to what to eat in a tray for restaurant."
Wow, that's... a learned mind.
Okay. So anyway, to sum up with bread again, I don't have to tell you that as time went on, okay, if you have a Jewish baker, there's no question, priority should be given to a Jewish baker, okay? Yeah, that's the other problem.
Otherwise, you go out in the field and you hope that a non-Jewish one.
No, we don't know that you have to go out in the field. I mean, the fact of the matter is that today, you know, again, the OU, okay, and this one and that one and so on, you know, they're busy giving hashkochas to all kinds of non-Jewish bakeries, okay? Why? Because, first of all, in many areas, there is no Jewish baker, okay?
I thought the rule was that in order for the bread to be kosher, at least the oven has to be lit by a Jew.
Okay. If the oven is lit by a Jew, then that makes it as if it were baked by a Jew.
All right. So
okay?
What do they go ahead and do when do they have a Jew that lights the ovens for them?
Yeah, or today they have automatic.
On that?
They have automatic lighting going on, too.
You don't have to have
right.
That.
Right, they have automatic lighting.
So it doesn't matter.
So that's, for example, once it's lit, it stays on 24 hours a day and just continues
the power
that
line
way.
Is on, it doesn't matter.
Right,
matter.
Right.
It doesn't go up. Is that
right.
What you mean?
Right, correct. Right.
That's
so if it's started by a Jew, then in that particular case, that would take it out of the...
10 years ago.
I mean, look, between you and me, the Big Y advertises its baked goods as being Pas Yisrael, right?
I don't know. Is that what
they do. Take a look on the label that you'll see over there. It's labeled Pas Yisrael. Means, in other words, this is Jewish baked goods, okay? The implication of Pas Yisrael, you know, Pas Yisrael is the opposite. Or at the beginning, Swilly lit it or something, and then it just works automatically. But that takes it out of the category of Pas Palter, which means, you know, the bread baked by a baker, but not necessarily a Jewish baker, remember, right? By a non-Jewish baker. And that makes it now Pas Yisrael, which is acceptable to those people who want to eat only Pas Yisrael. Okay? In New York City, and of course in many other places, you know, there are bakeries that are under very strict supervision. They're owned by Jews, they're Shomer Shabbos places, and so on. And so they glorify in the fact that they are Pas Yisrael, and of course you have, you know, an Olam that's looking for that, okay? For example, let's say you see Reisman's cakes in many supermarkets. Big Y carries them too.
Absolutely.
They're part of the cakes, okay? Yeah. And so that's Pas Yisrael, because it's baked by Jews. On Shabbos they don't bake it, and so on and so forth, okay? But as I said before, there are many breads. Take, for example, Arnold's bread. Okay? Arnold's breads are under the supervision of the OU. Now, there is a problem, however. The problem is that bread, strictly speaking, should only be parav.
True.
Why? In order to make sure that we won't have this business, let's say, that a piece of bread is baked with milk, understand, and then served with meat. at the same time. That's the problem.
Well, that is not good milk to begin with. Not good milk to begin with.
No. No, who says not good milk?
I mean, not kosher milk.
No, no, no. It's under, look, as I said before, inasmuch as we permit the use of milk today in America, okay? Wood's milk.
Right.
You can relic, you name it, okay? We permit that milk. So if you bake bread with it, it could be a kosher bread, but it is what? It's a milking bread. And as a result, the OU will not put the OU on a loaf of bread which contains milk in some form. What do? They simply put a K on it and figure, you know, that the bread, I mean, it doesn't contain non-kosher ingredients, but obviously when you read the instructions, you see that milk or whey or casein or something like that is one of the ingredients, and they don't want to violate the law. There are other agencies that won't even give any hechsher to a bread which contains milk in it, even though the ingredients may be kosher. Yes?
I'm sorry, why couldn't they just put an OU dairy on it?
Well, they do that with other things, but with bread they don't want to do it because, you know, it's an extra prohibition against them, as I say. That bread rolls should really be parva, so that you would not come to any mistake.
The bread
right.
that's in the, I seem to be losing my voice also. The bread that's in the big wine.
Yeah.
Is it only that big wine, or is it all?
It's
the
only in that big wine. Only there, not any other big wine bakery.
What about the Jewish bakeries they used to have that were open on Shabbos, but they were Jewish bread?
Well. So they fall into the category of being paspalter, if you wish, okay? Not Jewish bread, but it's
all
right.
That was the only bread we used to have.
Right, of course, I know that. Look, I mean, Gossip Hall is still open. They're still open these days, of course. Right, and Kibble, it's also no big Sonic, right. And particularly, I mean, that, you know, Grant is no longer there. Well, I'll tell you, with Gossip Hall, you have to be extra careful with the bread. And I'll tell you why. They not only make parva bread, but they also make milking bread. They make milking bread.
You have to know which is which.
Right. If it's behind the counter, then it's parv, okay? At least it should be. But they have a rack where they have all kinds of
rolls,
white bread.
Yeah.
Well, even with the rolls, potato rolls are dairy. The other rolls are parv.
Where is this?
At Gossip Hall. You got to be careful over there. You got to be careful. Well, during Passover, right, and immediately after Pesach, right.
So, but the rolls, the egg rolls.
Yeah.
Those are all
See, egg rolls are parv.
Right, and the water rolls are parv.
The water rolls are parv, correct. Well, if you take, you go to the rack where they have the other kinds of breads, like white bread, raisin bread, so that they bake, those are all dairy breads.
They're not marked, so.
I go in and I try to mark them dairy, but very often it gets by. Right?
Yeah. So let me ask you this, Doctor. Since they work on Shabbat,
right.
But they have a heksher, so they're under what is the definition now of paltar rather than paltar?
Yeah, so that's paltar, right.
Okay.
Right. I mean, in other words, they're no different from a non-Jewish baker in this regard. You understand?
Don't see much here.
Right.
But that means a non-Jewish baker who has had a Jew standing by.
If there's a Jew standing by and doing something, it's a mashgiach, or whatever he is, you know, at the time of the baking, or if he lights the fire, or he has he throws a match into it, or something or other. In that case, it's considered Pasiswell. Right.
The new word.
Yeah. Wait, so you're saying that the level of picture they have is different than that of a
pretty much so. Pretty much so. I mean, if they would be closed on Shabbos, on Yom Tov, you understand? I mean, then it would be a different category altogether. In New York, you have Shabbos Shabbos bakers, you know. But we don't have. Well, they close Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
Who is?
Gus and Paul. That they do.
Yeah.
Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, they're closed. But we tried to get them to be closed Pesach. We got them to do it 1 year, if you remember, but they said that they were losing too much money, and therefore...
Bill,
it
shows
me
that everything is perfect.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
At Diane, you're the Machiav there. At Diana, I'll tell you, okay. It's Paspalter. But she's careful to separate, you know, what's building, what's... And,
everything.
What's
power,
and they have two different ovens over there. Well, Gus and Paul has two different ovens too. I give them that credit. Yeah, that, you know, they have a power of the oven. That's where they make the breads and the rolls.
He doesn't make turkeys and so on,
right? That's a different problem. But now they have a different area, different stoves and so on that they use for that. Yeah, but they'll take and trade for turkeys. It's cheaper, so they take it in.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm
not 100% happy with them. What time is it? Yeah, I think we'll stop at this particular point because we're going to the page. Right. Okay.
5B.
Right. Today is the 14th of September, the year 2005, and we are now going to continue with the next item on the agenda, which is olive oil, shemen. And again, if you remember, the Mishnah said that the shemen of the Ivrit Kechovim, right, is prohibited for us to use, but we can get benefit from selling it or something like that. We can get Hanor from selling it. Okay. This is what the Mishnah had to say. Okay. So now they're going to analyze that.
And we can sell
and
we
are,
to
shemen. Shemen, right.
Sell kosher shemen.
Yes.
We're not allowed to use it.
Right. This is what the Mishnah tells us. All right, we'll see in a minute. Yeah, we'll see, right. We're going to get involved in the question now. Okay. So, we begin with the very last line on Vodazara Lamed Hay Omed Beis, and naturally, of course, we'll continue with Lamed Vov. Okay. They quote the Mishnah Hashem and Shalahem, right? And their olive oil. Okay. So, Shemen, concerning oil, we'll see that there's immediately a difference of opinion as to why the sages in the Mishnah wanted to prohibit it. Okay? Rav Omar. Remember that whenever you have Rav, you usually have Shmuel in the picture too.
Who was
okay.
Rav? Which Rav is that?
Okay. Rav and Shmuel were Talmidim. They were Babylonians. They came to Eretz Yisrael in order to study Torah, and they studied under Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Okay? And then they went back to Babylonia, and each one founded his own yeshiva. And we find time and again, you know, that they have different opinions as far as what Jewish law is.
Even
the
though they studied under the same people.
Even though they studied under the same, but each one had their own mind. Okay? They still had their own mind. Rav would say that the reason is for this, and the Shmuel would say that the reason is for this. Okay? And then occasionally you'll find the Rav and Shmuel, the Amri Tavayhu, which means Rav and Shmuel, both of them agree that this and this and this, okay? Right. So, you know, obviously, I mean, even though there were disagreements from the point of view of halacha, but there were also agreements among them as well. You know, I spoke this afternoon, you know, at Mincha Maariv, you know, about Hillel and Shabbai. Yeah. Only, of course, I only hinted at something.
I don't say this. Yes. Shammai didn't get bad publicity. It's just that most of the arguments, arguments
right.
they
were in favor of Hillel.
But that doesn't mean that Shammai got bad publicity. It's just that he didn't win the arguments.
Okay.
All.
No, he does get bad publicity because Hillel is pictured as being a very, very patient person.
And Shammai not.
You know, the famous story about the guy who came in. This is only one of the examples. But the guy who came and said, teach me the Torah during the time that I can stand on one foot. So he came to Shammai first, and Shammai knew that this is
ridiculous.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. He's not serious about learning Torah. So he threw him out. Okay.
He went to Hillel.
And, you know, again, he said the same thing to Hillel. So Hillel says, you really want to know what it is? Yeah. Okay. So he says, you know, whatever is hateful to you, don't do to the other person. Of course, it's based on the idea, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, but it's the interpretation, don't do harm to other people, just as you don't want to have harm done unto you. This is the klal gadol, so to speak, the important principle, and the rest is Torah.
Right.
And so therefore, the guy said, fine, if this is what the Torah is based on, then I want to sit down and I want to bring the rest
really
of the Torah. Right.
In essence, what he means is that our religion is based on respect for every human being.
Yes. But then, that's only the beginning. Then you have to go out and you have to learn religion. Okay. Including how a Jew is expected to live.
Right.
Okay. So that's why I say, but there are other stories too. Somebody made a bet that he could make Hillel angry, and then he was very angry that he lost the bet. Because Hillel is so patient with him and so on. And Hillel says to him, you know, better that you should lose the bet than that Hillel should become angry, something like that. So, you know, when you put the two of them together, that Shammai is the angry guy and Hillel is the nice, gentle, peace loving person, you know. So I'll tell you, who comes out better? Certainly from our point of view, Hillel, right?
But Hillel. We study in the ethics of fathers.
Right,
committed, as we all are, with
the
state.
Right,
you know, So, first of all, he knew how to say things in a very succinct way that had great meaning. Did Shammai show up in the Pirkei Avos?
Yes, I quoted Shammai tonight in Between Mincha Maariv. Right, and what he had to say is very nice. I'll tell you right now what he said. First of all, he says, make a fixed time for the study of Torah. Okay? And then he says, say little but do a lot.
Yes,
it's a Shabbat, okay? And then he says, and welcome.
I would have thought that was Hillel.
Well, this is Shabbat. And then Shabbat says, welcome everybody with a cheerful countenance. So that's why I say, I have to redeem his bad press. By quoting what he actually had to say in Pirkei
Avos.
Right, absolutely. All right, so now we come to the business of Shemen. And as I said, I gave you already. I gave you two sheets. Didn't I?
You gave me two.
Oh, no. My apologies. Okay.
Yeah, let me have those back.
Well, we've got to finish the line.
Yeah, I have one more line to go. Okay, now.
We need two of these.
Oh, did I give you two?
Yeah.
Oh, thanks. By the way, I want to tell you right now, this will be our last session before the holidays. Next week, if you remember at this time, there's the lecture by Rabbi Jacob Schachter.
Right.
And then 2 weeks from now, I have an all-day procedure that is going to take me from 8 o'clock in the morning until 4:30 in the afternoon. So I think I'll be a little bit farmatic at that time. So then we'll resume again in November, right? Because October, every Wednesday night is a Yom Kippur. So we'll resume in November.
Okay. I canceled all classes for the whole month.
Is it yantif sometimes? When is yantif?
Yantif?
Monday, Tuesday.
Monday night, Tuesday,
and
Wednesday.
And
this is true for all the holidays, and Yom Kippur is Wednesday night and Thursday.
Book is too.
Yeah,
book
is,
yeah,
all right. So every Wednesday.
So we'll meet for Hanukkah.
November? Yeah, it will be before Hanukkah yet. But the Birz Hashem. All right. So you asked me about Rav and Shmuel. I told you that they were great, outstanding Torah scholars who went to Babylonia and they founded their own yeshivas. And very often we find that each one has a different interpretation of what the halacha is. Okay? And they're quoted again hundreds of times. Okay. So Rav says, why was the olive oil of the idolater prohibited? So Rav Omar says, Daniel goes on a lot. He says that Daniel was the one who already said that you're not allowed to do it. We're talking about Daniel, the Daniel in the Bible.
Yeah, what authority did he have? He has the authority.
Those days, I mean, if he's that's the book of Daniel in the Bible, obviously he has authority. Okay, you understand?
But he was a prophet.
Daniel was not a prophet.
So how do you classify Daniel?
Daniel, you know the story.
He wasn't a prophet, he wasn't a judge.
He was one of the young people who were taken to Babylonia, to the court of the king, and to be raised. And one of the things that he refused to do is to eat any treifas over there. Understand?
What's that?
So, to eat anything that's treif.
Oh.
He refused.
Right, he refused to do it. So, that being the case, we have to assume, you know, that, you know, he must have had influence upon the Jewish community in Babylonia. Okay, when, you know, he became an adult and so on. And as a matter of fact, he became, you know, like the advisor to the king.
Right.
So that he
wound up in the fiery furnace.
Yeah. Fiery furnace was three pals of his. Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Right. Right. But he was thrown into the lion pit.
Or
the lion den, or whatever you want to call it.
I have his picture in my house.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So, at any rate, he made a gezerah. In other words, he made an edict not to use the olive oil of the goyim.
Shmuel,
on the other hand, said that's not the reason. He says, "Zlifoson shel kelim tameim usarton." So he said, "No, the reason why is because zlifon, which means literally what the kind of moisture that comes out of it, what exudes from something. Understand?" He says, this, which comes from vessels which are impure, this is the reason why, in other words, that if oil is stored in such a vessel, then in that particular case it's going to absorb the what? The tumor that's in there. Now, I have to make clear right at this moment, because in another moment we're going to have a different version where it says that it's unclean. And there's a difference between what we're talking about to mayim, as the Asher says it's going to be asurin, it's prohibited. They're two different concepts. What do we mean by tome? So this, we know that in the Bible we have all kinds of laws that pertain to what we call tuma and tara. In other words, being in a state of cleanliness or being in a state of impurity. Okay, so being in the state of impurity means that, for example, you cannot go into the Beis HaMikdosh and eat a sacrifice over there. Come into the Beis HaMikdosh, you have to be in a state of purity. First thing you have to do, for example, before you go to the Beis HaMikdosh, is go into a mikdosh, cleanse yourself. Okay, then you're allowed to go in over there. So as a matter of fact, I want to tell you that, you know, in Eretz Yisrael today, there are those who want to go up to the Har HaBayis, you know, to the Temple Mount, defying the Israeli government and defying the Arabs that are up on top over there. So, before they go, they would like to grab an adopting over there if they possibly can. But the Israeli government, the Arabs won't let them do it. So, you know.
Why up there? Part.
Why?
Yeah.
It's sacred. It's sacred to us Jews, the Temple Mount. This is where the Beis HaMikdash stood. There are people who are looking forward right now to the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash with everything that pertains to it. Okay?
Dr. Earp has a good point. The Beit HaMikdash didn't stand there. It stood opposite where the, you know, where the wall is, where the,
yeah.
Actually, I forget which group has it, where they have like a little...
Yeah, there's a tunnel if you go down over there, right, the Ataret Kohanim.
It was
yeah.
down, let's say,
yeah.
50 or 60 feet from where
right.
it was the tower.
Yeah, that's correct.
You
that's true.
You go on a
didn't
tour.
Didn't
right.
Okay.
right,
right. Exactly.
You're
see,
actually above.
I have to align myself, then why is the Har HaBayit so holy to us? Because it wasn't really even in existence.
Yeah, but nevertheless, the mountain itself has a significance to play. What did Yeshayahu say? Right, it'll come to pass in the end of days that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established higher than all the other mountains, etc., right? And all nations will stream unto it. A nation shall not lift up sword against nation.
So the guy
right,
who wants to go up there, let him wait till that time.
So,
can go
yeah,
there
but there are people who want to come.
Well, the point that you wanted to make is that they go to the mikveh before.
They have to go to the mikveh before because they have to be in a state of
purity.
Right. Okay. Now, we have very complicated rules concerning tumah. In other words, impurity that occurs, let's say, if, for example, sometimes even with dirty hands, it could cause impurity to sacred food. You understand? Or if you're in contact with a dead body, then automatically you can become tummy and things like that. Okay? Touch, for example, a sheretz, in other words, let's say a creeping creature or something like that, and that could also be a source of tumor. You understand? And tumor can also be transmitted to a certain degree to kalim, in other words, to vessels that are used, you know, for storage or cooking, whatever it may be, okay? And then in turn, it is possible in certain circumstances that the kalim transmit tumor to the food inside. So this is what the point is of Shmuel over here. What is he saying in this quotation? That it is the juices or something like that, slifosa, you know, of kalim to mayim, you know, of vessels which already are unclean, and of course in which what has been put, shaman has been put in there, you understand? The olive oil is there. So therefore, usalton, this is the reason why it makes it osir, makes it prohibited.
Well, isn't that the same reason for the milk that they use, or for
no.
the wine that they used to put in there, they put in
no.
different kalim?
There we didn't see, yeah, right, but we didn't see over there the inyan of tumah mentioned.
But why not?
There it was
is
a
it,
case
is
of wine.
Is wine and milk also food?
Yes. But the point was not made at that time in connection with tumah. Well, other things, no, you all have to understand. There, what is the basic reason for it? As we learned, it's a nosen tam. In other words, the vessel contains a certain tam in it, and the food that you put in it, in turn, you know, absorbs this tam. Okay, that's the reason. So that's why they didn't mention tumah before, but here, according to Shmuel, this is the reason why. Yeah? So immediately, the argument is against him.
Right.
It says, "Atu kuli alma erti taras ninhu." So they ask him, "Tell me, does everyone observe the fact that they eat only that which is tahor?"
Always.
So again, I don't mean that it's dirty. I don't mean that it's unsanitary.
Ritually
impure. There are certain things that have to be eaten in a state of purity. I mentioned before a sacrifice, okay? A Kohen, when he eats truma, or if he eats challah, by challah I mean, you know, the dough that's given to him, course, he can prepare it anyway from that point. But whatever he eats, that has to be in he has to be in a state of purity, as his family, whoever is going to join in the food with him. You understand? So those require. But for the average person who is sitting down to eat a meal, we don't require that it be tahor. Kosher, yes, but not tahor. See, there's a distinction between them. Okay?
Okay, so how do you...
Oh, we understand.
How are certain foods made tahor?
How is it made tahor?
Yeah.
It has to be prepared only by people who are in a state of tahor, so that they're not transmitting tumor to the object that they are making. Okay?
And how do they become pure? By going to the
mikveh. By going to the mikveh. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Is there any connection between that and, say,
Shmur Matzah? Yeah. You know. Shmur Matzah is a somewhat different business. The Torah says, Shmarta Mitzvah Matzah. You are to watch the Matzah, literally. Okay? So from this, we derive that from the very moment that it starts out as a grain, and you cut the grain, then you have to begin watching it very carefully.
Yeah.
This is Shmur Matzah, okay?
That's
right. All right. So now, all right. So I hope that I made this point clear, because now they're attacking this opinion that was made by Shmuel. Do you understand?
They were attacking it.
Right. They're attacking it. Okay. And I have to tell you that there were people who, after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, or even during the time of the Beis HaMikdash, but the important thing is that even after the time of the Beis HaMikdash, they ate food only when they were in a state of Tahara. And they were called Chaverim.
Chaverim.
They were called Chaverim, right. Because they took a special pledge, so to say, you know, that they would observe only this.
Like a brotherhood.
Right. Yeah. Correct. Chaverim. Right.
That's
so, but the average person was not a chaver. You understand? To be a chaver, you had to be highly learned.
Chaver is a friend, right?
Yeah, or associate, whatever you want, right? It has various meanings, you know. Right?
Associate.
So, right. So they were ochlei taros, but the average person is not. And this is why they're saying, what are you telling me about olive oil? Does everybody eat olive oil that's holding in the state of Tara?
Well, everybody went to the mikveh every day. He came Tara.
So Ella, right. So Ella, so therefore, what? But we have to sort of amend this statement. Namely, what? Slivoson shel kelim asurin osavta. In other words, it's what exudes and comes in contact with vessels that contain foods, you know, that were previously treif, right? This is what renders the shaman, that we can't use it. Okay? All right. So, this now represents the view of whom? Of Shmuel. Okay? Whereas, what did Rav say? Was Daniel, who already said no. Okay. So now they continue with this discussion to see. So Amalei Shmuel, the Rav, so Shmuel, in his argument, says to Rav, he says, Bishlamo Ludidi, as far as, according to my opinion, the Amino that I say is Livosan Shalkei Lamasurim Nesautan, that it is the, you know, whatever exudes of the liquid that comes out of the Kalim that have been used already before and are prohibited because they had prohibited foods in them. This is the reason that it makes the oil also makes it prohibited, right? And I knew, says, besides which, this is Techiosa Rav Yitzchak Bashmuel Bamarta, that when Rav Yitzchak, the son of Shmuel, the son of Marta, came, remember, whenever we have this expression, came, it means he came from Eretz Yisrael to Babylonia, okay? And he reported, you know, what he had learned in the yeshiva over there. And what did he report? The Omar, he said, Dorish Rabbi Siblai, B'Zintzivin, that Rabbi Siblai made the following Torah statement, if you wish, Drasha, you know, in the town of Nitzivin, that Sherman, as far as olive oil is concerned, was Rabbi Yehuda Vezdino Nimnu Allah Vitiruhu. Guess what? Rabbi Yehuda, in this case it means Rabbi Yehuda Nesiyah, who was the grandson of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. Right. Not the two, you know, not the original Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, but his grandson. Mm-hmm. So he and his Bezdin, they held a vote and they decided that they should permit the use of oil. Okay? So, why then did Shmuel say no? Says, because I say no for the reason, Kosovar, I'm of the opinion that nursing time, rather, Rabbi Yehuda and the Bezdin, why did they say that it's permitted? It's Kosovar, nursing time, the Vgam, Mutar. Okay? Now, I've already spoken about the idea of nursing time. Why did we say that the milk was prohibited, you know, according to those who wanted to prohibit it? Because of the fact that, you know, let's say whatever they were using, there would be a taste, you know, it's no good, right? But we do have another statement in connection with Nesin Tam, one of the important structures that you have to study when you're involved in kashrus, is that Nesin Tam Nufgan, if the taste is spoiled, the original taste is spoiled as a result of something else, and in that particular case, it is permitted. So, in other words, what is Rabbi Yehuda Nisir, right, and his Bezdin, what are they saying? They're saying that the shemen, the oil placed in a vessel which had previously been used, let's say, for some trefa liquid, the taste is going to be...